in the matter of McDonald Motors Corporation versus Delaney et al. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Yes, good afternoon. Robert W. McAndrew, McAndrew Photo, representing the appellant.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Paul Carbone, C-A-R-B-O-N, Margolis Edelstein, on behalf of the respondent defendants.
Welcome, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. McAndrew, please.
Your Honor, may I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Of course.
Mr. Chief Justice, Honorable Associate Justices, Counsel, may it please the court. When you enter this courtroom, you go through two doors, and on the doors you see the words New Jersey Supreme Court. And below those words, there are four more words, two of which are integrity and fairness. The law is a profession. It's a profession built on certain tenets that members of the profession must aspire to. Respect for the rule of law, integrity, honesty. Since the advent of the 1949 Constitution, this body has had the sole and exclusive authority to regulate the profession of law, and it has done so, including enacting rules of professional conduct, which set the minimum standard to which attorneys must adhere so as to make sure that our profession remains an honorable one. Central to a lot of those rules of professional conduct is disclosure, retainer agreements, settlements, communication with clients, respect for tribunals and adversaries and unrepresented people. We are asking the court today to review this situation because it is our position that it is contrary to the tenets of our profession for an attorney to conceal a known disqualifying conflict, and that it is actionable if the attorney does so. Secondly, we're asking the court to revisit and clarify the law regarding the application of the entire controversy doctrine to legal malpractice matters. In this case, the underlying matter was an action in lieu of prerogative writ, a specialized, streamlined process by which usually the assignment judge in the vicinage will review the actions of a municipal body and ask the municipality to then take different actions or affirm the action that they took. Legal malpractice cases are much different. They are filed in the law division in Superior Court with a jury. It's a track three case with 450 days of discovery, and more often than not, takes much longer than the 450 days. This case is here because it was dismissed on a motion in lieu of an answer under Rule 4:6-2. Even though the defendant had inserted into the record matters outside of the pleadings. So we have put before the court in the record the second amended complaint, which was the one dismissed and the one that the appellate division affirmed the dismissal. And it's very specific as to what we claim happened, what we allege happened, and everything that's in that second amended complaint has to be accepted as true for the purpose of the motion, which was ultimately granted. But it was not.
I have a question about that. How can this court consider, if at all, the stipulated facts from the action in lieu of prerogative writs that set forth in some detail the relationship between Mr. Delaney and Mr. Kane in a way that McDonald agreed to in that action. So I understood from the prior opinion, I think, of Judge Minkowitz, that the parties, including McDonald, stipulated certain facts about the relationship between Mr. Delaney and Mr. Kane in the prior action in lieu of prerogative writs. How can we consider those stipulated facts, if at all?
Well, I would suggest, Your Honor, that the way to consider that is that it was clear to Judge Minkowitz that Mr. Kane, the board member in question, had a disqualifying conflict, and therefore the board hearing was a sham because he did not recuse himself, okay? So the stipulated facts as to that all came from Mr. Delaney. Okay, those were stipulated facts, that Mr. Delaney had not made a full disclosure before the planning board.
Sorry, in terms of the stipulated facts, though, I thought Judge Minkowitz had said that both parties stipulated that those were true. So it was McDonald and Delaney stipulated that those facts were true, and it was not just allegations on Mr. Delaney's part, or even facts that Mr. Delaney himself stated and that McDonald disagreed with.
So, again, the posture of the case is that is a document inserted into the record by the defense by way of exculpating their conduct. Okay, so what does the court do with that? What the court, I suggest, does is say, okay, Mr. Delaney confessed. He stipulated to the full extent of the relationship, including being an executor of Mr. Kane's will, including being the alternate power of attorney, including notarizing the documents in his house with his wife and his son as witnesses. Those are the facts that give rise to the legal malpractice claim, negligent misrepresentation, intentional misrepresentation.
Are you saying there was a stipulation in the prerogative writ action was for the purposes of that case only, which involved the board and the applicant for land use relief, didn't involve the law firm? And so in that sense, the timing of when Mr. Delaney knew or should have known wasn't really germane to what was before Judge Minkowitz. What was germane was, is Mr. Kane out and conflicted out of the board because of that relationship? Am I gathering that might be why you're taking the position you're taking now?
Yes, I concur with that.
And why shouldn't you, though, putting aside the fact that your adversary probably argued this anyway, why aren't you judicially estopped from agreeing by stipulation in the prerogative writ action that he disclosed it as soon as he became aware, and in this case alleging he should have known from the outset?
So the stipulation was for the purpose of disclosing facts that were relative, that related to whether Mr. Kane had a conflict. Okay, there was no opportunity, or rather there was no need for an opportunity to challenge the veracity of those facts before in the prerogative writ action, because the concession of those facts prevailed and was anticipated to prevail in the prerogative writ action. So I don't think you can say that the adverse party, in this case McDonald Motors, in the prerogative, they were the adverse party to Mr. Delaney in the prerogative writ action, is now irrevocably tied to whatever that list of facts is, and is now barred from alleging in a separate legal malpractice case that he knew, should have known, did know, and deliberately concealed these facts.
What about the part of the stipulation that said that Kane and Delaney were on friendly terms and occasionally saw each other at local events but did not actively maintain a social relationship and did not engage in any business ventures together? That seemed to conflict with a part of the second amended complaint, which alleged that they did have a close personal relationship.
Yes.
So how do we, in an ordinary case, all facts in the second amended complaint must be accepted as true, and all inferences must be made in favor of the plaintiff. I'm asking in this case, how do we handle the fact that this exact same plaintiff previously stipulated to facts, some of which conflict with the facts they allege in the second amended complaint?
Your Honor, the reason is that in these litigated types of cases, Mr. Delaney, and I assume he had counsel, took it upon himself to stipulate certain facts which McDonald Motors agreed not to dispute. McDonald Motors wasn't stipulating those facts. They agreed that if he's going to stipulate that, we're okay with that because that wins the day for us.
But in theory, they could have objected, for example, to any stipulation about Kane and Delaney not having a close relationship.
He can, and we don't know what his answer is going to be in this case because he hasn't filed one yet. I'm sure it'll be the same. But the point of the legal malpractice case is that we have not been given the right to explore in discovery the truthfulness and the veracity of those statements. So we allege an alternate reality that, look, he knew of this. The proposition that he didn't realize until 8 days into the hearing process that he had a close relationship with Mr. Kane, that's a very dubious proposition, to say the least.
Can I ask you a question about your professional negligence count? There's no attorney-client relationship here. Delaney and McDonald are adversaries. What facts support the imposition of a duty under these circumstances?
No, I'm glad you asked that question, Your Honor, because I think it's central to several things. Number one, under the Petrillo case, we all know that an attorney has a duty to disclose facts that the attorney is aware of, even if the disclosure of those facts would be harmful to his client. And in that case, the attorney had soil samples on a piece of property his client was selling that were unfavorable. He sent his expert out to get more soil samples, which came back favorable. He only disclosed the favorable soil samples. And the court held, and rightfully so, the attorney had an obligation to that buyer, not his client, to his buyer, to disclose all of the soil samples. Secondly, the general public and a participant in any form of proceeding before a tribunal, I strongly suggest, has the right to rely on the fact that this is a fair and impartial hearing, and that I have no personal relationship with anyone who's sitting on this tribunal. And if I did, I would fully expect that that member with whom I have such a personal relationship would disclose it. That didn't happen. Mr. Kane didn't disclose it. So what next? Is the attorney's duty of integrity and fairness stop because it will conflict with his client's best interest? No. The attorney has a duty to the tribunal, to his adversary, to the adversary's party, to make that disclosure so that the next step is not a sham proceeding, so that the next step is not the game is rigged. That's what this case is about. So when this sorry, was there a question?
No, please go.
Okay. So when this case is decided, this court should send a message to all attorneys, and the general public should know this is not behavior that we expect from attorneys. If you know something, especially if it's a relationship with a member of the tribunal, that is going to undermine the fairness of the proceeding, you have an obligation to disclose it. I made this argument before the trial court and in the appellate division. If I'm assigned to a trial to a particular judge, and I know that judge because we're next door neighbors, we go out together, socialize with our spouses, I coach this judge's children in Little League and soccer, and I would fully expect the judge to say, I'm sorry, I can't be assigned to this case. You'll have to assign it to someone else because I have a relationship with Mr. McAndrew. But if that doesn't happen, then I have to step up. And then it's on me to step and say, Your Honor, I think it would be better if you recused yourself based on our personal relationship, and I'm sure Mr. Carbone would consent because we want to make sure that we and our clients don't run the risk of an unfair hearing.
But so, respectfully, it's not always that cut and dried. And in terms of sending a message, should the court, in recognizing a new duty or a new application of duty upon attorneys, bear in mind the impact on future processes for conflicts checks? A lot of experienced lawyers in this room and judges who were lawyers, and we well know that many times at the outset of a representation in a firm, conflict check is done by the computer and it doesn't catch something. Commonplace scenario, right? Are we, if we had recognized a duty that could support litigation in this case, are we going to have a chilling effect or an adverse effect on the regular processes of law firms to do conflict checks at their peril of being sued for money that not just disqualified and knocked out of the case, but to have to pay the legal fees of the other side? How do you respond to that policy concern?
Your Honor, what I would say is this. I am a zealous advocate, but I understand that the court does not have to go that far. A ruling would not have to be that far-reaching. The court can say in this case, based on the allegations of the second amended complaint, it's clear that A, it states the cause of action because we are finding that there is a duty of disclosure. And in this case, there was no disclosure. It doesn't have to lay down a bright line rule or it. So, during my clerkship, the associate justice I clerked for used to say, let's just decide the case that's in front of us, and I'm fine with that. So I don't think we have to go into, although, again, I'm zealous on this point. I think it's a fair point. I think it's a duty that attorneys have. I would urge the court to recognize that duty and recognize that if there's a breach of that duty, it is actionable.
Is it your position that if Mr. Delaney had disclosed the conflict that you allege at the beginning of the proceedings, then Mr. Kane would have recused himself, and then the board would have voted in your favor? What is your allegation as to what would have happened?
Well, we don't have to allege anything about what might have happened had Mr. Kane recused himself, because we only can deal with what did happen.
So is it your allegation that he would have recused himself if Mr. Delaney had disclosed what you perceive to be the conflict at the very beginning?
Okay. So when Mr. Delaney disclosed the conflict during the hearing, he didn't make a full disclosure. He made a misleading disclosure. So if he had made the same misleading disclosure at the outset, nothing would have changed because the board attorney reviewed it and said there's no conflict.
But at that point, why didn't the board attorney have an obligation to ask Mr. Kane for the facts? Why wasn't Mr. Delaney's disclosure enough to put the board attorney on notice that the board attorney needed to do some digging and figure out if there was a conflict here?
I have no answer for that because I don't know why the board attorney was the board attorney. Exactly what he looked at, because we don't have any discovery in this case. So, but be that as it may, should Mr. Kane have recused himself? Yes. Did he? No. And because he didn't, should Mr. Delaney have said something? Yes. Did he? No. It went in an action in lieu of prerogative writ, and Judge Minkowitz said absolutely 100%. It's a disqualifying conflict. Mr. Kane should have recused himself. Now you have to go back to the day one of the hearing, start all over again without Mr. Kane participating.
The focus of your damages claim, as I understand it, are what we'll describe as the wasted counsel fees incurred by your side in 8 days of hearing, all right? And that the delay in disclosing the conflict or discovering the conflict more fully ended up causing your client to lose all that time and effort, right? Wouldn't, though, an attorney on the other side who had the conflict have an incentive, economically and otherwise, to identify the conflict for so that his own client didn't waste money on 8 days of hearings? Why doesn't that economic incentive satisfy this concern about damage, putting aside disciplinary action or something? Doesn't he have an incentive to make sure he's not wasting his own client's money?
Your Honor, in an abstract world, yes. But unfortunately, this planet is inhabited by humans who are fallible, make bad decisions all the time. We can make people live longer, be healthier, be more intelligent, but we can't make them stop making bad decisions, okay? So it's a bad decision on his part, and I don't think we can speculate on whether or not he had an incentive. So, you know, there are attorneys out there who don't worry about incentives or what their clients are paying. They just want to win. And this case should stand for the proposition is, yes, you want to your client to be successful, but not at any cost. You want them to be successful within the rules, within the loyalty to your profession, within your duty to the tribunal, to your adversaries, and to the parties.
I thought you just mentioned that Judge Minkowitz had remanded to the board for a complete do-over of all of the hearings, but I thought when I read the order that it was just a remand for a new vote without Mr. Kane's participation.
Your Honor, I'm pretty sure the remand was to start anew without Mr. Kane participating.
Okay.
Questions, anyone? Anything else you'd like to present?
No, Your Honor, I thank you so much.
Thank you. Mr. Carbone.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, counsel. May it please the court. We're here on a grant of a petition following two dismissals and an affirmance by the appellate division on motions to dismiss. These were not motions and an appellate record that was slim or scarce. It was fully briefed and argued at the trial court level both times and fully at the appellate division. In the record, before the trial court was Judge Spinkowitz's decision based on stipulated facts, as the court noted. Also in the record, in the second trial court motion to dismiss, was the transcript of the, I believe it was May 24, 2018 hearing, wherein Mr. Inglesino, who is counsel for the board, disclosed to the board a call that he had received from Mr. Delaney about the conflict. And Mr. Inglesino disclosed what Mr. Delaney relayed to him about the conflict. And in addition, Mr. Delaney added further to Mr. Inglesino's comment, and I refer the court to the appellant's appendix before the appellate division at 112A through 117A. So Mr. Inglesino at 112A recounts what Mr. Delaney told him about the conflict, and then Mr. Delaney adds, Mr. Inglesino, I quote, Mr. Inglesino, thank you for that eloquent analysis. Just also for the record, I did not draft any of those documents. Those documents are drafted by my former partner, who's no longer with our firm. I don't know if that is a factor or not, but I want the fact disclosed. Certainly, I called you, as I said to you last month, when I learned of all of this, and immediately called you because I talked to my partners and asked whether I had an ethical obligation to disclose it. They felt I should, and I did call you. Certainly, a less than ethical person may have thought about not disclosing it. But certainly, I felt under the circumstances, as an officer of the court, I felt I had to. Certainly, I feel very strongly there is no conflict. I don't think it should affect the proceedings. I would hope that after a year of board, we'll have a vote, but I understand, first of all, I extend the time, and second of all, certainly I understand the circumstances. The time we are spending to brief would make sense. So what happens after that? There is full briefing. There is briefing by his visions, the applicant and the board. There is briefing by McDonald Motors. And there is a decision and opinion by Mr. Inglesino, who represents the board, advises the board, ultimately, after all of the briefing and consideration, that there is no conflict and Kane can be part of the vote. The application is approved, I believe, by a vote of either 8 or 9.
Mr. Carbone, I'm sorry to interrupt your opening statement. We're familiar with the facts. I would encourage you to try to address the legal issues.
Certainly, Your Honor. All I would like to say, Your Honor, and with regard to the stipulated facts, one of the questions of the court and the suggestion by counsel was that the stipulated facts was by Mr. Delaney. It wasn't by Mr. Delaney. I have it here. It was presented by the Inglesino firm who represented the board. And it was approved and consented to by McDonald's Court. The trial court and the appellate division decision adequately considered not only a first amended complaint, but a second amended complaint. The plaintiff was allowed to replead. It did so. It still failed on the causes of action asserted, and the appellate division affirmed. I'll leave the remainder of the time for the court's questions.
How about your reaction of how we should evaluate or use Judge Minkowitz's findings? I'm looking at pages 104A and 105A of the material, in which he very strongly concludes that there was a qualifying conflict here. I'll just read a couple of things from it. By designating, I want to add Mr. Delaney as the executor of his will, Mr. Kane must have felt he could trust Delaney with the important task of distributing his assets upon his death. This is a great responsibility, one akin to asking a family member to execute a will, even a family member who may not be particularly close. It is not irrational to think that Kane's decision on the application could have been swayed by his current and ongoing connection with Delaney. The fact that Mr. Delaney was unaware of the conflict also is of no matter. Mr. Delaney's current status as a fiduciary, by definition, implicates him in a close relationship, and then he goes on. So should, just as you're asking us to accept the stipulations that were in the prerogative writ action, should we also accept Judge Minkowitz's findings that from the get-go, this was a conflict situation and also, as he said earlier, an appearance of impropriety? Aren't we guided by those findings here?
I would tend to agree, Your Honor. However, as I recall reading Judge Minkowitz's decision, I believe that he concluded that Kane had the conflict. Now, Mr. Delaney disclosed the conflict. When did he disclose the conflict? They say too late. We say, under the RPCs, he disclosed before a decision was made on the application in time and further extension of time to be able to evaluate the issue as to whether Kane should recuse or not recuse, could vote or not vote.
Is that an adequate remedy?
I believe so.
Everyone has spent 8 days on a proceeding that's tainted.
Well, I believe that Judge Minkowitz, with his remand, on the prerogative writ, simply couldn't, wasn't the application then going to be subject to all the prior the proceedings that already occurred, and Kane would be removed from the decision. And by the way, I believe that under the municipal statutes that even if Kane recused himself, the application still would have been approved. There would have been a quorum. In other words, Kane was not necessary to the decision. They're claiming damages of attorney's fees and so forth. He still would have incurred the attorney's fees because he was going to object to the application.
They voted again and approved it based on the record that had been developed. That's what you're saying?
Factually. Yes, I believe so. I believe that had they pursued, had his visions pursued the application again, I think the municipal, the planning board would have reviewed the record. There would have been, Kane would have been removed from the proceeding. They would have reviewed the record of the testimony of the various experts, the testimony of the witnesses, and they would have voted.
What if Mr.
Kane?
They didn't
pursue it.
They did not.
So that was the end of the matter.
That was the end of the matter. There was no further proceedings other than this lawsuit and lawsuit by his visions.
Sorry, can you say that one more time? So it went back to the board for consideration anew, and then his vision never objected and the order stood? They never revoted or anything like that?
His visions never went back to the planning board after the decision by Judge Minkowitz. There was no further proceedings. So that soul food restaurant or cafeteria, however it's going to be characterized, was never opened at 51 Bank Street in Morristown. As it turned out, his visions, and I don't know whether they opened it under the entity named His Visions, but they opened a different restaurant at the other end of town in Morristown.
There's an allegation in the complaint, in paragraph 8 of the complaint, that the personal relationship was known at the outset to Mr. Delaney. Shouldn't he have, under those circumstances, made the disclosure at the outset, assuming the truth of the allegation as we are supposed to at this point in time?
I understand that allegation is there, Your Honor, and I understand that on a motion to dismiss, the court has to accept the allegations as true. I believe that Kane was in the best position to disclose. He certainly would know and would be in the best position to remember that, you know, Mr. Delaney, I went to Mr. Delaney's house to have my will notarized, and Mr. Delaney is the alternate executor, and his partner, Mr. Chester, in 2014.
Does that remove the obligation attorney has?
I'm sorry?
Does that remove the obligation on the attorney?
I think that the attorney, once the attorney derives knowledge or remembers, I think the obligation to disclose is there. So, under the RPCs, and he did.
But, so what do we do with the fact that this cause of action has been dismissed based on the assumption, as you just recounted, that he disclosed it when he found out about it, which is contrary to what we have in the complaint as alleged?
Your Honor, the fact of the matter is, you know, I may represent, I certainly would have Mr. Delaney was advanced in years beyond my age, not by much, but certainly I think I may have a better memory than someone of Mr. Delaney's age at the time, but are we to put an imposition on lawyers that they have to remember everything all the time and absolutely at
maybe not every time? Maybe not everything, but how about who's your friend?
Sure.
Whose will are you on?
Well, perhaps Mr. Delaney notarized many wills. He was a former mayor of Morristown, was a partner at a firm, a local firm, and then ultimately at Lindaberry. And he could have been an executor or notarized many, many wills, Your Honors.
When it comes to the allegation that there was a close personal relationship, what do we do with these stipulated facts from the action in lieu of prerogative writ that said that Kane and Delaney are on friendly terms and they occasionally see each other at local events, but they do not actively maintain a social relationship? Who stipulated to those facts?
I think the lower courts, no one disputes that the standard was misapplied by the by the lower courts. I mean, the law is the law on a motion to dismiss. And I think the lower courts appropriately considered Judge Minkowitz's decision and the stipulated facts stated therein, as this court in the Banco Popular case has indicated, you could look not only to the allegations of the complaint, but matters of public record and documents, exhibits attached to the complaint and documents that form the basis of a claim. Judge Minkowitz's decision obviously is a public record. The stipulated facts was a public record. Judge Minkowitz's decision actually includes all the stipulated facts in his decision. So I think it was appropriate for the court to consider, the lower courts to consider that.
I thought what Justice Wiener-Hector was saying is how should Judge Minkowitz have considered the stipulation of facts because it disagrees with the second amended complaint? And on a motion to dismiss, you only consider the allegations in the complaint and consider them as true. What's the interplay there? Was Judge Minkowitz correct in considering the stipulation of facts, or does that now turn it into a motion for summary judgment? I think there was more what she was asking.
Your Honor, you mean the lower courts? Judge Minkowitz is at the prerogative writ?
Yes.
So the question is, if I understand correctly, how could the lower courts here...
When you say lower courts, who are you referring to?
Trial court and appellate division.
Not Judge Minkowitz.
Minkowitz
was the action in lieu of prerogative writ. Then there was a different trial court and active panel that considered this case, correct?
Okay. Right, because this case that's before your honors was not...
Let me change my question now that I'm correct. In the trial court, what is the interplay between the stipulation of facts and the second amended complaint, since they disagree? How does the lower court, the trial court, consider that?
The way I think the lower courts, the trial court, and the appellate division appropriately considered Judge Minkowitz's decision, and it was certainly before the record, both at the trial court and the appellate division. And I think that the way the court appropriately considered was to determine whether a disclosure was made. And in fact, the Second Amendment complaint alleges that a disclosure was made.
Was made late.
Well, the argument by the appellate is that you didn't disclose enough.
What does that have to do with the stipulation of facts? You have a stipulation of facts where both parties are admitting certain things are true. It disagrees with the Second Amendment complaint. Which controls? Or neither, or both?
Well, I think that the stipulated facts, I think the court has to consider the allegations of the complaint and consider the stipulated facts, which are a matter of public record.
That's a matter outside of the pleadings.
Well, it's a public. It is outside the pleadings, Your Honor.
Public record documents might be the court may be able to take judicial notice of those, but the standard of 462 is you are limited to the court is limited to what is alleged in the pleadings, and if in fact it considers matters outside of the pleadings, it becomes a summary judgment motion. That didn't happen here.
Your Honor, this court in Banco Popular has stated, in evaluating a motion to dismiss, courts consider allegations in the complaint, exhibits attached to the complaint, matters of public record, and documents that form the basis of a claim.
But a matter of public record is not a document from a different case. It wasn't attached to the complaint.
It wasn't attached to the complaint. I agree with that, but it does relate to the case.
Sure, there are matters that relate to the case, and courts can convert those motions into summary judgment motions if they're considering matters extraneous to the pleadings. It doesn't mean that the motion can't be decided, but it's no longer a pure 462 motion.
Your Honor, I would submit that under this court's decision in Banco Popular and other cases, that was appropriately considered by the lower courts on a motion to dismiss under 462, and it did not need to be converted to a motion for summary judgment.
Let me ask you this analytically again, coming back to Judge Minkowitz. Let's accept, for the sake of discussion, that there was no close personal relationship between Mr. Kane and Mr. Delaney as was stipulated. Let's just assume that. Does that rule out, though, that a conflict existed? Because Judge Minkowitz said it doesn't matter whether they thought they had a close personal relationship because of Mr. Kane's status as providing or as having Mr. Delaney be the executor of his will, be the contingent power of attorney, that regardless of whether there's a clash about close personal relationship between the Second Amendment complaint and the stipulation, Judge Minkowitz analytically said that doesn't control here because of the undisputed fact that he was the executor. So what do we deal with? How do we deal with that? Do you disagree with Judge Minkowitz's finding that having no close personal relationship doesn't matter given these facts about it, the executor status?
When I reviewed and analyzed Judge Minkowitz's decision for the first time, and then I did it again a couple other times, I came to the same conclusion, and I disagreed with Judge Minkowitz's opinion that there was a conflict that affected Kane's ability to impartially vote on the application. Having said that, my client has to live with the fact that Judge Minkowitz decided that there was a conflict and that there needed to be a new vote on the application.
Did you appeal that decision?
I'm sorry?
Did you appeal that decision?
There was no appeal to that decision, Your Honor.
Counsel, if Mr. McAndrew had served as executor for the trial judge in this case, would that pose an issue from your perspective?
Yes, and I think he would need to disclose it.
At the outset of the proceedings?
At some point when he realizes, or obviously if he knew, I mean, if he's walking into the courthouse on the arguments or a motion to dismiss, and he makes the disclosure,
And I'm not saying... I'm going to change the name to John Smith. What if John Smith had not done so?
What if John Smith had not done so?
Yes.
Then I think it would be an issue.
And how would it unfold? What legal consequences would there be?
Well, I certainly could make a motion to strike the decision, disqualify the judge. I certainly I would have to consider whether I have an ethical obligation to file a grievance against an attorney, and that's another issue here. If McDonald's Motors Corp believes that Mr. Delaney did not disclose everything fully, then the recourse maybe is an ethical grievance, but not a negligence claim under Petrillo. This court has cabined those cases. What plaintiff is trying to do here is go back to the more recent decisions of this court that have cabined an attorney's duty to non-clients.
But here he's seeking damages, okay? And I thought you had argued, maybe I'm wrong, that how can he demonstrate damage here when the disclosure did not result in a recusal? He continued to participate and vote, and the action in lieu of prerogative writs would have been required in any event. Did you make that argument?
I did, Your Honor. And Mr. Kane was not without counsel. The board was not without counsel. Mr. Inglesino, after full briefing by the parties on the application, provided advice to the board.
Is that decision in the record anywhere?
The decision by Mr. Inglesino?
Correct.
I don't believe so. That may have been under an private executive session, but I am not aware of any transcript on that, Your Honor.
Or the briefing, also not in the record.
I have the briefing. And I have the briefing here that was submitted, and there was an extension of time. Mr. Delaney, on behalf of his visions, granted an extension of time
regardless,
on the application.
Mr. Kane did not recuse.
Correct.
He participated. They decided, and action in lieu of prerogative writs was filed, which would have been required because he didn't recuse and apparently didn't find a conflict.
So Mr. Delaney could not force Mr. Kane to recuse. Only Mr. Kane could recuse.
Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
and therefore there was no damage.
Correct. He would have incurred the attorney's fees for the application because he was going to object anyway. He was going to object, and then he lost, and he would have lost even if Kane recused himself because there was a quorum, and the quorum decided to approve the application. So he had to file, and if he wanted to pursue it further, file the prerogative writ and incur those fees and costs, and he did.
Did you? No. You've also argued that the entire controversy doctrine should apply in this matter?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it your position that in the prerogative writ action, plaintiff had to bring Delaney and the law firm in as part of an effort to overturn the zoning board's decision?
Yes, Your Honor. My esteemed colleague has argued that you can't bring a legal malpractice claim in a prerogative writ because prerogative writ action doesn't deal with damages. I thought
his argument, respectfully, was that you don't have to bring the legal malpractice under Olds versus Donnelly, the legal malpractice claim in under the entire controversy doctrine. And I want to ask you about that because how do you square the position you're taking with Olds? I mean, I think Circle Chevrolet would have supported you back in the day, but it's no longer with us. We now have Olds as the guiding case. How can you square that argument with Olds?
The current state of the law is that claims that should be brought in one proceeding ought to be brought, and it no longer requires...
Do you agree that the current state of the law, though, is that there's no mandatory party joiner?
Yes.
So should is not the same as must?
Correct.
So we have issues that are related, no doubt, but different parties, different legal theories, different relief that is sought in the two actions. How does that favor application of the entire controversy doctrine in the circumstances here?
I disagree with the court on different legal theories because attorney's fees and costs were pled in the prerogative writ complaint.
Attorney fees and costs for the whole board proceeding and the action in lieu of prerogative writ? I wasn't sure from the record.
You know, I know that there was an application made for at the prerogative writ stage by McDonald's Corp for tax costs dealing with, I think, the transcripts of the proceeding. I do not recall whether, I don't recall whether there was an application for attorney's
fees. Well, not against law firm.
Not against
Lindenberg. The board would be immune from having to pay anything, of course, right? And the applicant would have had no legal responsibility under those circumstances, to at least our knowledge. So the party that he would be wanting to seek reimbursement of fees from wasn't even in the case, right?
At the prerogative writ stage, that's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
So, and how what would be the theory under which legal fees, as opposed to costs, would be compensable in the prerogative writ action?
Against which
part? Against anyone. Award of legal fees.
I think they sought the attorney's fees under 4:49. I think under the court rule, seeking attorney's fees and costs. I don't do much prerogative writ, but I suspect there might be a provision.
But I thought you said that it was limited to an award of tax costs, not legal fees.
I don't believe that they made a motion for legal fees and costs, although it was pled in the complaint. And that was one of the items that the trial court noted in the decision in this case.
Other questions, anyone? Mr. Carbone, anything about that?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both, counsel. No, I'm sorry. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I will submit.
Thank you to both counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.